Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our CVAG Executive Committee meeting, which is on Monday, March 16th at 4 o'clock here at Coachella Water District, Steve Robbins Administration Building. I do know that we have a couple of individuals, Joey DeKunick at Blythe City Hall, who's coming in by video, remote location, and then as well, I'm not sure if he's on yet, but Mr. Scott Mattis in Tempe, Arizona. And so with that said, folks, I'm going to try to see if we can keep this meeting to an hour, but I highly doubt it. I try to keep them to an hour because after a while, people just goes off, right? But it depends how long you guys want to take it. So with that being said, I'll call this meeting to order. And Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
City of Desert Hot Springs. City of Coachella.
Present.
City of Palm Springs.
Present.
City of India.
Present.
29 Palms Band of Mission Indian.
Present.
Torres Martinez Desert Kuya Indian. Cabezon Band of Kuya Indian.
Here.
Agua Caliente Band of Kuya Indian.
Here.
City of Indian Wells.
Here.
City of Cathedral City.
Here.
City of Palm Desert.
Here.
City of La Quinta.
Present.
City of Blythe.
Here.
County of Riverside.
Here.
City of Rancho Mirage.
Present.
Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Ms. Naomi Soto to lead the Pledge of Allegiance, if you don't mind. That's right, ma'am.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Amen.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Any agenda modifications?
There are none.
Any conflict of interest disclosures? Anybody? Great, seeing none. Any public comments on any agenda items?
None, Chair. I've received no request to speak.
None? Okay. Our Executive Director, any announcements?
Yeah, I've actually got a few. Put a couple of slides up to guide my announcements. One, just a reminder to everybody on meeting logistics. The microphones are in the ceiling and they could pick up just about anything. If you're whispering to your colleague, everybody might hear it. And you do have video in the, or at least cameras in the corners that might be picking up what you're reading in front of you as well. With respect to congressional earmarks, a lot of the agencies have submitted congressional earmarks. It's that time of year again. CVAG also submitted a few this year and, of course, signed on as letters of support for many of the agencies' earmark request. We've submitted two really for CV Sync, one with Congressman Calvert for bringing in Rancho Mirage into CV Sync with the support of the city of Rancho Mirage. We submitted another one with our two senators for all of Varner Road, $5 million request there. I don't think we have a really great chance of getting that one when they're thinking about statewide requests with the two senators. And we're also put in with Congressman Ruiz for a $5 million extension of CV Link into the community of Thermal with the support of our county supervisor. So those would be the three from CVAG, and we're crossing our fingers that we get one or all of those. With respect to a couple of other quick announcements, next. Supervisor, you unfortunately missed this because they scheduled it on the wrong day of the year or the wrong day of the week for you. This was a Tuesday of a month or two ago where the Secretary of Transportation, State Transportation, came down and celebrated efforts related to fixing Varner Road between Bob Hope and Monterey Avenue. It was identified as one of the worst safety stretches of street in the state of California. And we all kind of know that when you think about the In-N-Out Burger and trucks and everything else going on there. There are a lot of accidents there, and the state came in and said, this is one of the five worst in the state, and they're going to help us with some money. I haven't seen it yet, but they say they're going to help us with some money.
They did on us three times.
They sure did. Next, a couple of awards. You might recognize your colleague, Jan Harnick, there from the city of Palm Desert. Jan Harnick represents CVAG at something called CalCOG. It's not an agency or an entity that many of you are probably not familiar with, but it's California Associate, California Council of Governments. Thank you.
Yes.
So it's a statewide organization that represents regional agencies like SCAG and CVAG and WRCOG. They do an award ceremony. This one was held in Long Beach last week. Jan got kind of a lifetime achievement award for her effort with SCAG, RCTC, and CVAG. And we got a nice award as well, a Eureka Award for CV Link. It's nice to get recognized for that outside of the Coachella Valley too. Lastly, just a little update on our use of drones related to CV Link. As some of you know, we continue to, now that we've built CV Link, now we're operating and maintaining it. And our biggest challenge really is how to control those damn little motorcycles that are running around on CV Link. It's happening both in the eastern part of the Coachella Valley as well as the western. We've been really working with the city of Palm Springs that has taken off, as it were, with use of drones and enforcing various things in the city of Palm Springs. We provided a drone. Thank you, Jonathan, for spearheading this effort. And that drone's been up in the air in Palm Springs. It will be, if it hasn't already, in Cathedral City and is in Indio or soon to be in Indio. We look forward to doing it everywhere else along CV Link. And they nabbed their first culprits just a few days ago. And I say nabbed, they were 14-year-old kids who had a nice joyride, you know, riding down CV Link at 45 miles an hour and had no idea that Lieutenant Hutchinson was just sipping his coffee, watching them the entire way. They pull up on a street and they stop. A cruiser comes up to them and suggests they don't do that any time again. They issued them a warning, didn't find them, and I suspect that's probably enough to keep at least those kids off CV Link in the future. So all good, and thank you, Mayor, for your police department support there. That's the extent of my announcements.
Well, thank you for the report, and just real quick on that issue. What's the image look like? Is there signage that says no motorcycles? I assume there is.
We have some signs out there. We're working on some more enforcement signs, and we're actually working on a ordinance just to make it very clear what is allowed and what isn't. And maybe one reason why there is just a warning, not more than that at this stage.
Okay. And congratulations, obviously, to yourself and our team here at CVAG, and as well to Jen Harnick for the good work that she's done. And with that said, folks, we're moving on to number four, consent calendar. Are there any items that anybody wants to pull?
Consent?
Yes.
Just one quick question that I may, forgive me, it's my first executive council meeting. The rapid response program, I noticed that had zero. Are we allowed to
get the plus? Okay, is that, where is that here?
I'm sorry, item A, the regard to the grant applications for CV housing.
Well, why don't we just pull that real quick? That's fine.
Okay.
We're going to pull that way. You can speak to it.
Perfect.
Is there any other items? All right. Seeing that, is there a motion?
Move an amended consent calendar, La Quinta.
Second.
There's a first by La Quinta, a second by City of Indio. Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
And you could do this by overwhelming consent if you like.
Okay. You know. Even though we have folks.
You will just turn to Mayor de Kunick, but everybody else could say aye or nay. Or
all right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Joey?
Yes.
All right.
Scott.
And I don't think Scott Mattis is on yet. And I do want to, this might be a good opportunity for all of you to be introduced to Nick Norvell, who represents CVAG with BBNK. And so next time we have a point of order, he's here in person. We could ask him directly rather than we do plug into him virtually for most of our meetings.
Now he's in the flesh.
Good to be.
All right, thanks for being here. Why don't we go ahead and go back to the consent calendar, specifically 4A. Mr. Truby.
Yeah, just one quick question. And it was about the rapid response program. It had, you know, duck eggs. And I'm just wondering what the rapid response program is. And it didn't seem to have any activity.
I think this is actually item 4B. It's our annual report. Erica, why don't you explain why there was a zero there?
Yeah,
Yes, thank you for the question. So those of you who've been with CVAG may remember that we have two basic parts of our Housing First program. One is the kind of the CSH, the crisis stabilization units, and the other is rapid resolution. As you pointed out, those are low hanging fruits. Those are like individuals might need a bus pass home, or they might need something fixed on their vehicle, and then they can maintain employment. They're relatively rare because we're dealing with chronically homeless individuals. So it's not uncommon for you to see zeros. However, we're very much data-driven, very transparent metrics. So you often see it on the Housing First report. And it does relate to A too, as we are going after grant funding. So hopefully you'll pass that one too.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you. I'm glad you looked it into A because we pulled out of A. All right, all those in favor?
We'll move approval on item 4A.
Thank you.
Second.
So there's a motion by Katir C, a second by Laquita. Everybody to approve, say aye. Thank you. I'm sorry, Joey?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. And Scott's not on yet?
It's not.
Okay, gotcha. All right, moving on to item 5, discussion action items 5A, CBAG's audit for fiscal year 2024. 2025 related reports, none other than our own Claude Kilgore.
Oh, that's me. Thank you, Chair. And I think I know everyone, but if I haven't met you before, I'm Claude Kilgore, the finance director here with CBAG, CDCC, and the other agencies we staff. This is a receive and file item covering CBAG's audited financial statements and related reports through the year ended June 30th, 2025, and that's a balance sheet date, so that's a point in time, right? And it's also the activity for that year, which is the revenue and expenses, if you will, in layman's terms for that. So the audit firm from Davis Farr CPAs, Shannon was a partner there. She actually presented the results to the Finance Committee back in March 3rd. And just want to shout out the members present included Council Member Wild from the City of Rancho Mirage, Council Member Harnick from the City of Palm Desert, the City Clerk and Interim City Manager from the City of Blythe, Mallory Chryselius, City of Desert Hot Springs City Manager Dora Willems, and City Manager from the City of Palm Springs, Scott Stiles. So they already reviewed this, and Shannon presented an unmodified opinion on the report, and there were no audit findings, actually, luckily. We had a clean report, if you will, and they also performed work under the Single Audit Act, which is when you get over $750,000 in federal funds, you have to comply with some of these Single Audit Act provisions of federal expenditures. So more about that's in your staff report 5A. I do want to highlight the really significant year CBAG had, as it its net position actually grew by almost $80 million, and that brought it up to a little over $300 million. And that's an increase of about 35% in 1 year. And I think that's really significant. If you think about the net position of an agency, it's much like your own net worth. So imagine that growing 35% in 1 year. And that's really a testament to these folks behind me on the transportation team who we capitalize a lot of assets for the infrastructure projects like CB Link, the regional synchronization program we're going after earmarks on, and the CB Link multimodal pathway. Since that was finished up, we capitalized a lot there. So a lot of great done work there. And really throughout the East Valley too, there was a lot of projects on regional arterials. So since the Finance Committee already vetted the results, I thought I'd give you that little high-level overview and see if we could skip the presentation unless the chair wants that.
I'm going to ask my colleagues, do you want to see the presentation?
Clean audit. We love clean audits.
See anybody beaming for it?
All right. Well, we do have the auditor on the line if there's any questions, or I can answer them now. Otherwise, it's a receive and file item. And I'm here.
Well, thank you, Claude. Mm-hmm. Any questions for Claude?
So this incorporated, was this the parallel system based on the transition of the systems or fully integrated under the new?
It was not quite parallel yet. Actually, the transactions were parallel. So next year's audit, and that's a good point. We did extend the executive committee. You all extended the auditor's tenure one more year for next year because we went through an enterprise resource planning system, the whole contracts, accounting, everything was recently implemented starting July 1st. So we did have a period where we were booking transactions in both. So some of the auditor's procedures involve testing transactions that happen after year end. Really, it's called a search for unrecorded liabilities. Imagine if we didn't book something in the prior year, but we paid in the current year. So I think to answer your questions, no, but it did encompass a little bit of the new year because they looked at transactions to make sure they didn't belong in the prior year.
Well, and I bring that up because of the additional work and need to have the information available as that trend happening for July 1st kickoff. So I commend you and the staff for that process, knowing that it's going to be better for us going forward, but it's not easy when you have to go through it.
It was a tough year. I appreciate you calling that out.
Okay, so Scott Mattis is now on, I understand. Scott?
Mayor Mattis, can you hear us?
There he is. All right, can you hear us, Scott?
Yes. Yes.
Go Dodgers, buddy. Can you hear that?
Yes.
All right, so this is a receive and file. Thank you, Clive, but you're also with 5B. Fraud hotline, Clark.
That's right. Let's just jump into that. So a few years ago, under Tom's authority, we had a consultant come in and do an operational overview of our finance department, made some recommendations. I think all the A level, A, B, and C was the tiers we got. The A was get a new ERP system, which here we are. We've done that. There are some other large items we could, low-hanging fruit. I think Erica just used that term that we were able to pick off. Some of the smaller ones were establishing a fraud hotline. And, you know, I think fraud, we got to put a microscope under it. I'm sure you have similar hotlines at your organization. It could be there and not know it. And I wanted to point this picture out because it could happen at any level, whether it's someone in my position, at your agency or at CVAGS or at a cashiering position, you know, fraud can be there. So it's important to be mindful of that. When I think of fraud as a certified public accountant, I think of it in kind of two aspects. We'll talk about fraud prevention first. And fraud prevention is really dealing with internal controls, right? What are some of those? We have segregation of duties. So someone at the front desk opens our checks, and then someone in accounting makes a deposit that's different than the person that's actually doing the reconciliations in the book. So segregation of duties, I would say, is a type of fraud prevention. It's going to stop someone from doing it because they don't have access of all points of that critical path. Another type of fraud prevention internal control would be dual signatories, right? Unless there's collusion, which there's been collusion before out there, but unless there's collusion, you know, you can't really, that's going to prevent fraud because you have two signatories. On the other hand, you have fraud detection, right? So prevention and detection, obviously that's a little more after the fact. You can think of that microscope or magnifying glass, I guess it is, that we saw at the beginning. You know, that's detecting something after it already happened. So when I think about a fraud hotline, I don't really think, and maybe someone disagrees, speak up, but it's not really a fraud prevention measure. I don't think a robber who's going to rob a house thinks, oh no, someone's going to use the phone to call 911 on me. Right? They're thinking of it more maybe as a, it might be more of a detection measure. And it's not the only detection measure that we have. We have other internal controls too, like bank reconciliations. Cash is still king, or if cash isn't flowing out, there's online payments. And that all flows through a bank statement and you reconcile that to your books. I think that's another fraud detection method. If you see something after the fact, we can find it internally. Another internal control is the financial statement audit. You know, that's going to come in after the fact and help identify fraud. So to me, this is just another tool in the fraud detection toolbox, if you will, to help us maybe highlight any issues that could be there and give staff an opportunity to speak up if they see fraud, waste, abuse of CVAG resources. So Stop It Solutions is the program that we're looking to implement. And we actually get this product for free. I know several of your jurisdictions are members in the self-insurance pool that CBAG is. That's the California Joint Powers Insurance Authority. So we have a zero cost contract for Stop It Solutions. And what their tool does, it allows for whistleblowers, if we want to call it that, to report anonymously if there's been any type of fraud, waste, or abuse that they've seen within the agency. And from there, they can do that actually three different ways. On their web app they'll have on their phone, they can do it on their desktop, or they can actually call a phone number to alert the back end of this potential incident of fraud, waste, or abuse. And that message is going to come up, and we've designated that to an HR function. So someone in HR would receive that, as well as we thought, again, to prevent collusion, we'd want two people to receive that. So we're going to have a director also be in the loop on those initial complaints, if that's what we want to call it. And there would be a director that's not a signatory is what we're looking at now. Again, I don't think I've said we're implementing this kind of after today, so open for suggestions. But after that complaint comes in, it goes to HR and a non-signatory director. Then it will go to one of these three individuals. Right now, it'd be myself, Tom, or Erica. And if one of these three people were implemented in that incident, of course, they wouldn't be notified. And then from there, it would be elevated up to the finance committee chair. And as was suggested by the finance committee when I presented this earlier in the month, also to legal counsel. Nick, I don't know if I let you know that, but you're going to get some help. So we think that's going to be a helpful process. So that's a little overview of what we're trying to do. And we just look for your approval to roll out this plan. We haven't had any incidents that we're aware of, but we definitely want to give this opportunity to have the fraud hotline and include the chair of the finance committee and legal counsel in that reporting process.
Well, thank you, Claude. That was very specific and very technical. I appreciate you walking us through that. And I never even knew this type of thing even existed. But it's good to hear that we're going to move in that direction. Kind of reminds me of what happened either in Beaumont or Banning. I don't know how many years ago, it wasn't too long ago, where the city manager and the city attorney and the mayor and I don't know how many people were in cahoots. Do you recall that?
I don't. It must precede me.
Yeah, it was about maybe 5 years ago, but some folks are nodding their head. Right. In any event, all right, well, they found fraud among all these individuals. My colleagues, any points, any thoughts, ideas?
Can I just ask, how are you going to advertise it? Is it internal? The people you're hoping to get access to this are internal. So how are you going to? You're going to make posters?
Yeah, that's a great question. We'll definitely have flyers up. We're going to have all staff meetings where we discuss this with them. And, you know, everyone at some point is going to probably have to download this app on their phone. So they're going to get all trained on this.
All right, thank you.
And then is there a reporting mechanism back to the finance committee on the annual basis of anything that might have, without obviously specific detail per se, that would lend itself to having the finance committee be responsible for changing policies, practices? I mean, if things happen on this line, how does the committee learn about the reporting mechanism?
I think that's a great point. So we did build in the finance committee chair to part of the reporting process. So you mean above and beyond that, the incidents that don't make it to that level?
And maybe the finance committee determines if it stayed there. You know, I guess it's similar to Tom's authority to sign contracts up to a certain limit, at least quarterly or a couple times a year, we get what those are, even though he's just so we have, it's spirit of transparency. So we have some knowledge about what's going on. So
I think the finance committee would be responsible as, half of those people are elected officials and the other half are actually appointed. So they would be responsible, as I understand it, to take it to the broader committee if it raised to that issue.
We haven't thought through this, what kind of reporting might be done on an annual basis. My guess is we're going to have a zero again, most years, if not hopefully every year. What you could do is make a recommendation, approve the staff finance committee recommendation, and ask staff to come back probably with the receive and file information on how incidents are reported, perhaps both the finance committee as well as the entire executive committee.
I think that this would be helpful, especially in the audit next time that comes around. Has anything been identified? Has anybody brought up concerns? You'll have that tracking mechanism.
I think that's great. It would be a download of the system, and we'd be happy to present it along with the audit results each year.
Any other questions or thoughts from my colleague? Is there a motion with the amendment that you're going to come back and maybe provide us some sort of process for us to get there, and then we'll receive it filed at that time? And so is there a motion?
Indio.
Second. Indio. Second by whom?
Cathedral City.
A Cathedral City. Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Joey?
Yes.
Scott?
Aye.
Thank you. That passes and moved forward. Next is item C, next steps for the Arts and Music Line Project. Randy Bowman.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Next steps for the Arts and Music Line. You have seen several of these slides before, so I'm just going to breeze through them. The Arts and Music Line is in the three cities of La Quinta, Indio, and Coachella, as well as some unincorporated county with some side street improvements as well. Here's where we are presently with the project. We are wrapping up plans. We are actively acquiring the easements that are necessary for the project, all to get us to a construction start next year. And really, we expect it to be about a two-year project. We continue to expect that. Let's talk about money. I think that's a big reason why we're here today. You all are aware that CVAG received a $36.5 million ATP grant a few years ago now. Well, as Executive Director Kirk announced, I think at the last meeting I was at, we were hoping to get more money from the state, and we did. We got $20 million in CMAC money awarded to us through SCAG. We're very grateful for that. That will offset most of the construction cost that we would pay to a construction contractor to build the project. These are the numbers as they presently stand for the project. It's about an $88.2 million project. The green numbers represent that which is going to be split between CVAG and the three cities. I would also like to point out that as part of our right-of-way negotiations, we signed on the county as an additional outside funder for the project. We're going to be receiving approximately $250,000 from the county to offset the right-of-way cost to acquire easements from the county. So we're happy to have the county come on board. And if you want to give more money, we're happy to accept that too. Renderings of the project, you've seen these a lot. It's a class four along Avenue 48, plus with a couple of connections to the CV Link, which would be class one or like that bike path, much of which CV Link is a class one facility. And I wanted to point out that we are in discussion with California Transportation Commission and Caltrans on changing how the project connects to the CV Link at the east end of the project. If you recall, the project as initially proposed to CTC for the ATP grant was going to connect along Dillon Road to the CV Link. In discussions with 29 Palms, there are some tribal interests in developing along Dillon Road that would pose a problem for incorporating the bike path along Dillon Road. So we've been pursuing an alternate connection to CV Link along, I call it Old Avenue 48. It's Avenue 48 extended east of 111. And we are going to be proposing a scope change to the CTC by June. We've had our initial discussion with Caltrans, and they're in favor of it. Actually, with the ATP funds for the project would actually go even further with this change in the connection. So today, oh, I forgot CV Links right there. So today we're asking for three actions from the executive committee, a resolution that helps us seal the deal in doing the grant agreement for the $20 million. Plus authorizing Executive Director Tom to do all the other necessary steps to finish acquiring the right-of-way. And then lastly, of course, to amend the agreements, the ongoing agreements we have with La Quinta, Indio, and Coachella for the reimbursements. Plus, thinking ahead, we're going to need to amend an agreement with CVWD for the portion of the project that will be within the La Quinta evacuation channel, as well as execute an agreement with the county for the reimbursement of the $250,000. Any questions?
No. Okay. Anybody else?
I'm just getting ready to move approval.
Mm-hmm. I got you. Mike? Glenn?
Close. let me ask you a question. So because of the tribal interests, I know they're doing a hotel and doing other stuff at 29 Palms. Is there a way that that is eventually, either through CV Link or through the music line, is it going to connect with 29 Palms somehow? Because you would think that would be a great opportunity for people staying at that hotel or to be able to go there, to be able to cross over on that path, either to, when they have their new hotel, to the music line or into La Quinta, India, or Coachella. But if they're going over there, does it connect somewhere to their properties?
We hope that in the future that there will be an opportunity. You know, there is an interest in replacing the bridge, the Dillon Road Bridge over right. the Whitewater Channel. Plus, there have been some longstanding hopes for improving the interchange of Dillon Road with 86. So I think that would be something in the future, but not right now.
Yeah, because I think both are tribes that we have partnerships with, Cabazon and 29, to be able to make sure that their hotels are connected into that, to go not only to music festivals, but also all the other events that are there. So I think somehow we need to work with them to be able to facilitate that opportunity.
Thank you. Anybody else? College? You know, I saw some renderings or some photos there that you had for certain areas. Do you have them for every area, or are you going to have stops, or like on the county area? I know you said something. I saw La Quinta, I saw Angel, but I'm wondering if you have them all already. If you can show us those sometime.
I'll bring back some additional. We'll have one that will show what the facility looks like in the unincorporated areas as well, in addition to the ones that I have up.
All right, good. Well, thank you for that. There's a motion by Mr. Truby. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Lynn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Mr. Scott Mattis?
Aye.
Joey?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Unanimous. And moving on, we are now with item D, additional authorities for CV Sync Phase 2 construction. Jonathan?
Yes. Good afternoon, Honorable Chair, members of the committee. Talk to you about additional authorities for CV Sync Phase 2. Just to review, the CV Sync program is not only interconnecting traffic signals, but it's also enhancing safety, reducing congestion, and really setting the technological foundation for all the future connected vehicles and other mobility apps that will come in the future. We started work back in 2022 on phase one of this project, and this was completed in the summer of 2024. We're currently working on phase two, trying to finish that up this summer. By June, we should be finished with phase two. That includes the TMC that we've relocated into the Thousand Palms area at the Ranch Mirage Corporate Yard facility. We are also in design of Varner Road, which we're calling phase three. And as Tom Kirk mentioned, seeking an earmark for funding for the construction of that phase. We've also working with Ranch Mirage on phase four. Phase four is the remainder section of Rancho Mirage Streets. We did secure about $6.5 million of STIP funding for that project, which is about a $13 million estimate at this moment. And then we also requested an earmark for additional funding phase four project. So going back to phase two, which we're working on now, when this was approved at the time, I think the $86.7 million was the most expensive construction contract that CBAG have ever executed. And when we awarded it, we did not do the typical 10% contingency. Why didn't we do the 10% contingency? Probably because it was the $86 million, the biggest contract we had ever done. And adding another $8.6 million at that time to start, we chose not to do that. We chose to come back if needed and challenged our team and the contractor to work through with the $86 million that was available, looking at savings where they could. But over the last 3 years of construction, there has been things that have come up that are unavoidable. Some of the items, and they're detailed in an attachment to the staff report, but I'll go over them here, are a new regional TMC. This was relocated from our old building on Desert to Rancho Mirage. We also had some changes to local TMCs For example, in Indio, we relocated a TMC for their Indio site, actually in near the Golden Voice ground, so that they could help manage festivals better and coordinate different locations on TMC improvements with the different agencies. We also encountered unforeseen circumstances, such as once you start digging and unearthing things, you find out what's there or not, if it's broken or slurry-filled conduits, different challenges, damages to conduits. So those were changes that typically happen in any construction project. And another issue was over 3 years, you can imagine the technological upgrades that happen with different software, equipment, and models. We have to upgrade those, and it led to additional cost. And on top of that, we're building this project over 3 years, but development throughout the valley is still going on. So if a new traffic signal goes in Cathedral City, or a new traffic signals go in by a developer or a city project, a capital project, that has to go into the network, and then we splice it in, add new nodes, put everything in, and that has to be changes that the contractor makes. So with all of those changes over the last 3 years, separate from those construction changes, that original contract, we came back to the committee back in 2023, and we chose to add a bid alternate, which was Avenue 50 in Indio, to include that whole corridor into the CV Sync Phase 2. We also worked with Indio to come up with an agreement where we could co-locate our fiber in the conduits that Indio was, that we were putting in, that Indio could use that, and we could use the conduit together. So we increased the contract value. And now what we're proposing to do is to go back and add that 8.6, that original 10% contingency on the original contract amount. We've identified $7 million worth of changes that I detailed earlier, but we're going to recommend the 8.6 to go with the 10% of that original 2022 estimate. That gives us a little cushion. We're looking at Rancho Mirage and getting their existing Highway 111 and Bob Hope, and they have equipment there that we can actually tie into our system now. And then when their phase four comes on, it'll be the remainder of Rancho Mirage. Maybe able to add that, this contingency, as well as having about another $1 million of contingency to get us through any unexpecteds that happen between now and June. With that, I'll speak my staff report. I'm happy to answer any question.
Thank you, Jonathan. Any questions or thoughts by my colleagues? All right, is there a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Then? Second by City Coachella, Mr. Figueroa. And all of the favor say aye. Scott?
Aye.
And Joey?
Yes.
Okay. Unanimous. Thank you. Jonathan, you're on again. Continued analysis of cash flow concerns. Letter
E. Timely.
Thank you. The staff has presented a number of presentations for the last 5 years about cash flows. Back in 2020, staff identified a shortfall in projected cash flow. We looked at the projected projects that we saw coming forward. We looked out into around this time and saw that we'd have a $20 million deficit. At the time when we came to executive committee, the direction we received was to keep monitoring the cash flow, monitor what's happening at the state and the feds, because at that time in 2020, there was a new administration coming in, there may be new funds available. And then also, in the meantime, let's get projects shovel ready and be ready to compete when funding is released. Fortunately, there was a new infrastructure bill that came out in 2021, and that funneled money into state and federal programs. And we competed for those. As mentioned by Randy a minute ago, we received $36 million for the arts and music line. We were tied first in the state for LT cap, we call it, for Indian Canyon in Palm Springs. We got $50 million for that. Tom Kirk directed staff to work with RCTC and identify any agreements in our multiple agreements to make sure we were getting our fair share. We worked with their staff cooperatively, and we identified that. We identified $26.2 million in federal funding that should come to the Coachella Valley. We programmed that for Monroe Interchange. We also identified another $14 million in local partnership program from the state that should come to the Valley. We put that on Monroe Street Interchange. And then we identified another $50 million of at-risk funding, because CMAQ money used to be programmed by us, and a few years back, the feds and the state changed it, and now you have to compete through SCAG. So we identified some funding that was still on the table. We programmed it, and that went to the CVSync program. We just talked about it a minute ago. We've also most recently put in projects for SCAG funding, the new way you compete for that funding. India was awarded $30 million for the Monroe Street interchange and the $20 million for arts and music line. So it sounds like we did really well. We competed for about, in the last 5 years, $226 million. That's a lot of money that we've competed for, not formula funds, but it seems like we take two steps forward and another back, because at the same time, construction costs have just been skyrocketing everywhere, including Southern California and the Coachella Valley, for example. Not to pick on Monroe Street, but it is our next big project. Looking at how we do cost sharing, once we take account for state and federal funds, the local share is split 75% right now is the policy for CVAG, and then 25% for the locals. When you look at back in 2020, interchange at Monroe was about $89 million. You look at it, what it is now, it's about $175 million, and it's going out to bid this summer. We see what the actual cost is, right? When the bid's coming. And that not only affects Indio, but it also affects all of the agencies. We have a CVAG has a policy of cost sharing. When we did the Jefferson interchange the last time, there was a trip generation study that was performed and the cost was shared. That local's 25% cost was split amongst all the agencies based on usage. We've done an update to that study now and see here how the percentage of trips shares throughout the whole valley. There will be all the cities will be affected by this big project. And when you look at the recently completed interchanges, the last seven we've done to date, including Jefferson was the last one. And I've included Monroe Street because that's ready for construction. We've secured about 65% of that cost of that $400 million in outside funding, state and federal funding, and we have 35% local. But when you look at the next seven on the horizon, you can see that we have 0.5% of outside funding. So there's a huge burden for interchange projects. Again, the average cost of an interchange back in the last seven was about $58 million, and now the average cost is about $113 million. So it just demonstrates how significant these large interchange projects are. So we look forward at the current projections. We looked at putting in only the contracts that we have executed with member agencies, including Monroe Interchange, to construct it. And we look out into the future and we see another negative $4 million. And that's without new projects on the horizon that are proposed. So we've looked at just to review the revenue and expenditures when we come up with these cash flows. As far as formula foreign funds that we depend on, the Measure A is about $24 million. We have TUMF, which is driven by development. Last year it was about $7 million. We're projecting a decrease of about $5 million going forward. STIP, when we look at the average that we get on an annual basis, it's about $3 million. That's something every 2 years we get to program whatever's available state for regional projects. And then we think about those projects, we think of maintaining them. And backbone SB1 was approved, I think, in 2017. This is all the local gas tax money that goes to your agencies to take care of your streets. And they doubled that at that time. And we still know, based on the consent item for the updated pavement management, that this isn't enough. This is not enough for local agencies, and it's not enough for regional. I think just looking at regional streets, just to keep our pavement in the current condition, it's about $22 million a year investment. That doesn't include local streets. So maintaining is also an issue. So what do we do? This is the point of this staff recommendation to form an ad hoc committee to look forward and be a sounding board for policy on what things we can do, whether it's different options. And we've kind of outlined a few of them here. This is something that the formula share that we have, 75-25, wasn't always the case. I think it changed about 2008. Before that, it was a 50-50. We look at adjusting the portion and share on projects. Do we look at TUMF? And we can look at the local TUMF that we collect for a unit, for a housing unit, compared to the Western Riverside County. It's significant. But even if you charge the maximum and looking at development, it's all bottlenecked by how much development's happening. It's going to limit how much funding you'll have. And this also goes to our TPPS and TUMF update that's happening now, which should be done this year. We're looking at an excess study for the TUMF and looking at project criteria for the TPPS. So this could be something that we would consider raising the TUMF. This would be an item for the ad hoc committee to discuss. We could also look at what we receive in taxes. And we currently get about 0.5% in sales tax. Is there opportunities? What were the steps needed to look at increasing that? We can look at as well how we go through different funding, different phases. We currently go through and fund every phase, and we come up with a new agreement when we're ready to go forward with that phase. Maybe we restrict that to just construction or just pre-construction. Put a spending limit on what we do. Maybe we look at just, hey, let's not do interchanges anymore. There's lots of things. These are big decisions that this ad hoc committee would be providing guidance for. We're looking for volunteers for to sit on the committee. We've taken this before the transportation committee, and we've also taken it to finance committee. There is in the staff report a list of some of those that have identified themselves as wanting to participate. The recommendation is to direct Tom Kirk to form this ad hoc committee, taking special care not to form a quorum of some existing standing committee. And with that, I'm going to pass to Tom.
Well, and just to update, I think we've got a volunteer or volunteered from each of the jurisdictions. So I'm not looking for volunteers, but to Jonathan's point, we didn't want to form a committee that included a quorum of any one of our existing committees. And I think we've got it. I do want the authority to form the committee. The committee will probably meet 3 or 4 times over the next 6 or 7 months. And I don't expect the committee to spend much more time than that.
Tom, if I might add, the committee will have representation from all the agencies, whether it's elected or staff.
Yes.
You want to announce who they are? Have people taken the time to take a look at that? Do people know who the folks are?
The 249.
Yeah, I do have it in the staff report. There might have been a couple of additions. With La Quinta, we had either Kathleen Fitzpatrick or John McMillan. We might go with John just for purposes of avoiding a quorum on transportation, but I've got to double count that one. But other than that, and we do have even Margaret Park has volunteered on behalf of Agua Caliente, which aren't officially a TUMP, but they collect an in-lieu TUMP, and thank you for doing that.
Just very quickly, the rest are Raymond Gregory, City of Coachella to be determined, City of Desert Hot Springs, Mayor Scott Mattis, City of Indian Wells, City Manager Chris Freeland, City of Indio, City Manager Brian Montgomery. You already mentioned City of La Quinta, City of Palm Desert, Councilmember Jan Harnick, City of Palm Springs, and City of Ranch Ross to be determined. And myself, I guess, for the County of Riverside. I just wanted to make sure folks were aware if you haven't had a chance to look at the staff report. Any other questions, ideas, thoughts by my colleagues?
When will the results come back and who will it go to?
The initial, one of the key task will be working on the TUMF for updating our Nexus study. That Nexus study will be reviewed and some of the assumptions probably determined by the TUMF advisory committee. It'll then go to transportation and then come back to the executive committee for final approval. And everything else likely involving any money would ultimately come back to the executive committee for approval if there are any other proposed policy changes.
Because TUMP's difficult because it goes to housing, it goes right on top of it. Housing is expensive as it is, and you continue to do that, especially to some of the smaller ones we're trying to get built that aren't a lot of profitable. I mean, the big multi-million ones doesn't really matter, or some of that housing tracks. When you start talking about affordable housing, townhouses, condominium stuff for that are starter homes, that really adds on to those. So, I mean, I would personally think if you could have a regional approach like the sales tax where everybody's paying it and it divides up. that's simpler than they're trying to keep going those fees on top of those individual cities, and then you add our fees that are adding up all the time because our costs are going up, and then somebody before they put a stick in the ground, there's $60,000 into this thing. So
sounds like you should be on the ad hoc.
Is the TUMP study due by the end of our fiscal year or calendar year?
It's not due in any particular time, but it'll be done by the end of the calendar year, right, Randy?
So we may have some shakeup on some of these.
Might be
members.
Affordability is certainly a factor that ought to be considered, as well as working on Jackson interchange, which is $177 million, and finding the money to make that happen.
Insanity.
It is insanity.
And if we don't do intersections, who does?
Nobody.
Nobody.
State doesn't step in.
Crumble.
Yeah. And there's a less and less money from the state of California for these types of projects. They don't like capacity enhancing projects.
Any other questions, thoughts from my colleagues? Is there a motion for approval?
Second.
Is that Reed? And second by Linda?
Sure.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
And Joey?
Yes.
Thank you. That's unanimous. And moving on to the last item, at least here with the report that we have here, item 5A. And this is an item that was brought forward to us by Mayor Taylor, request to discuss flight patterns at Palm Springs International Airport and associated noise concerns. And I guess I'll just give you the floor.
Okay, thank you. So the FAA changed the landing pattern coming into Palm Springs last June. And I was first approached by a resident in September saying, pay attention. The noise is loud and the airplanes are landing straight overhead for the first time that this person had been and lived in the city for over 30 years. So I started paying attention. And sure enough, after doing a series of investigations into the nature of this, the FAA has updated landing patterns throughout the United States, as they do from time to time. Collecting data, et cetera, and they have changed the landing pattern so that it flies right over Indian Wells. And this change was done, without notice, if you will. And we then started to do what one does as a city, which is to raise your hand and ask why the changes took place. So we first approached Palm Springs Airport, and we've had a meeting with the executive director now, and we have an excellent resident of our city who is a 30-year commercial pilot, and so speaks the same language, et cetera. The Palm Springs Airport ultimately said this is an FAA issue. It's true, it has changed. So direct your attention to the FAA. So we've directed our attention to the FAA, and the FAA has responded at first by saying it's a safety issue. So we said, public records request, please send us all the safety issues for the previous landing pattern for the past 10 years. So far, nothing. I wouldn't be surprised to get some kind of more detailed information on that or not. But they also then recommended that we go back to Palm Springs Airport and receive a recommendation from Palm Springs Airport to give the FAA for a suggested landing path. Going back and meeting with the executive committee, we presented a landing pattern and have asked for their approval. That was last Friday. I have submitted a map, a very rough map that will be sent around later, unless it can be shown on the screen now. It can't be, okay. That shows a variety of things. And maybe we'll work with each other so that you can understand the color coding of the map. But it shows the original landing pattern that's been there for 20 years. It shows the current landing pattern. And then it shows a recommended landing pattern, which is kind of in between the former one and the current one. So when we had a city council meeting and directed those people who were concerned about this to, you know, write letters of concern for in the noise committee of the Palm Springs Airport, almost 10% of our entire city wrote letters. I'm surprised, but I mean, it's literally to the point where I can't go to the grocery store without getting approached on this particular issue. We have a variety of individuals that are prepared to potentially take legal action in the event that an amicable solution with the FAA can't be resolved. You know, there's a lot of precedent for the FAA changing flight patterns, including Newport Beach in 2016, and legal action being taken, settlements being achieved, movement and flight patterns being done. And so I'm raising this issue with CVAC just to make you guys aware of it. Because the flight pattern kind of a little bit avoids La Quinta, touches La Quinta a little bit, not too bad, but it goes right over Palm Desert, which it didn't before, and Rancho Mirage, where it's gone for years because you're right in front of the landing pattern. But, you know, it's worth taking note, paying attention, and see, you know, what your communities are going to say, because we've reached out to Ken Calvert, and we're going to go back and meet with the FAA, and we're going to try and find an amicable resolution here. So at the end of the day, that's the quick update. And to the extent that you guys have any comments or want any information, I'm happy to provide that. And to the extent that we raise our hand later and ask for additional support from CVAG, we will. But in the meantime, that's the update.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Happy to take any questions.
Yes, Lynn.
I've received complaints from our residents that live up in Magnesia Falls Cove. It's switched. I personally used to live over at Tamarisk, and you could tell the time of day by the flight pattern. So it's shifted a little bit. I have a question, and maybe in your discussions, if they said the reason for the change was safety, is it due to wind patterns, size of jets?
Yeah, so they that's what I've asked for. I've asked for all that detailed information. What our expert believes, that the landing pattern is kind of tight, actually. So it was largely over Cathedral City and the kind of the 10 freeway, where you would pull a pretty tight circle where the plane would really come in at an angle and then come down for a landing. That tightness, you know, is uncomfortable for passengers, especially on a windy evening, and, you know, can put a little more stress on an airplane than just taking kind of a longer circuitous straight landing into Palm Springs. So whereas we have not received any specific safety matters, and my hunch is there won't be any, but I reserve comment to be corrected by data if there is any, that this is really more of about that when pilots land today, they press a button to automatically land. And this is quite frankly, the simplest, straightest way to land into Palm Springs Airport with the least amount of stress on the pilot or the plane. So.
Interesting. I remember once coming in from Washington, D.C. and flying into Palm Springs. It actually took us all the way to South Sea. And then we did that turn.
Right.
But yeah, that was 3 years back, but I remember that.
Yeah, and we have precedent in that when you do a visual landing, like a lot of the old timers do, been coming in for 30 years, they like to visually land and land manually. They actually land currently at our recommended landing pattern. So there's precedent for that landing pattern. And our B suggested landing pattern is one that United Airlines uses, which is a little more of a loop, coming a little more into La Quinta, but more kind of over the mountains coming down versus straight over residential communities. So anyway.
Any other questions for Mayor Colbert? Yes, Reed.
You say you were going to make available some maps.
Yeah.
Proposed.
Yeah.
Where can we find those?
I've sent them, sent one around. I have many maps, but I will, maybe what I'll do is I will send you the complete set with my email that was sent to the executive director of the Palm Springs Airport with some modifications. And should I send that to you, Tom?
Yeah,
you can forward it to this team?
Sure.
Thank you. Any other questions or thoughts?
Yeah, one more question.
Yes,
thanks for talking about this. A couple opportunities as well. I don't know if you've for kind of ongoing exploration of impacted cities or any other ongoing issues, but is this come up in the airport commission that is also represented by all the other cities as well? Or have you thought about utilizing the commission to kind of?
Yeah, you know, the challenge is the executive director was crystal clear. We don't set landing patterns, yeah. The FAA does.
Yeah.
So as much as we could meet and talk about these things, you need to talk to the FAA. And their lobbyist advisor was in the meeting, who represents LAX and Burbank and John Wayne, et cetera, and has experience in changing land patterns. And they said, you know, asking PSP for their advice is a total deflection. So what you need to do is get in front of the FAA. So also ultimately, yeah, that's fine. And we suggested that Palm Springs, who prepared a really nice deck on current landing patterns and why it's the FAA, you know, to come to our city and do a presentation. They've offered to come to every city to make a presentation, but at the end of the day, it's not going to change the landing pattern.
I'm sorry. Could it be the increase in number of flights? So that way, if you take a wider arc, if you will, they can stack up a little bit easier versus the previous part.
Yeah, so, you know, I didn't know this, but it makes common sense, right, once you hear it, that it's the planes that land in Palm Springs Airport, it's like a bell curve, right? So during the summer months, you know, there may be 15 to 20 planes that land a day. But in this month, there are 75. And the month prior is 70, and next month is 70, and then it kind of goes down from there. So one of the things we feel, of course, when our cities are the most populated due to the seasonality of the nature of our valley, is that we, you know, when the most people are here, there's the most noise and the most planes landing. So that's why at the end of the day, this is probably more of a seasonal thing than it is otherwise. But, you know, the FAA likes to have a consistent landing pattern throughout the years.
Any other questions or thoughts? Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor, for bringing this forward. Appreciate the information. And so that's just information. Moving on, obviously, item six is informational items. Hopefully that's in your packet. Take a look at that.
And there, on legislative items, Jesse Ramirez with the League is not here. Kiana Valentine, who represents CVAG and is the principal at the political group, is online. And she's prepared to provide a brief report on state legislative matters and what's up for CVAG and regional agencies.
Okay.
Kiana?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Emphasis on brief, as I know that you still have some business before you this evening. Next slide, please. I'm going to just kind of jam through what's on the slide and try to focus on the things that I think are most relevant to CVAG at the moment and what I'm working with Tom and in the CVAG staff on. I was going to touch briefly on the political context, a little bit about the state budget and what's going on with transportation funding, and then some interesting transportation intersection of climate policy. Next slide, please. I don't know who put that in there, but yes, Gavin Newsom is in his final year of his second term. So we will have a new governor come this time next year. Senate President Pro Tem is now Senator Monique Lamone from Santa Barbara, and she took over from Senator Mike McGuire, who was from the North Coast, and she'll be in power for the next couple of years. She's considered a short time leader, if you will, too, with just a few years left in her tenure in the Senate. And then there are changes because of her turnover and leadership that focus on some of the committees that we follow closely. So we have a new chair of appropriations, Assembly Member Ana Caballero. Senator Laird is chairing Budget Committee, and then Senator Eloise Gomez-Reyes from San Bernardino chairing Senate Budget Subcommittee 2 on Resources. So those are some of the committees that we interact with most frequently. As you all recall, voters were given an opportunity to determine if Congress was going to have new seats for the next three election cycles, and they did that in the affirmative. So it certainly scrambled the political maps here in Sacramento, and there's a lot of focus on the upcoming November election. There are also several ballot initiatives that are being talked about in Sacramento that could appear on the November ballot, including one around CEQA reform, and then one that we're acutely keeping an eye on around local taxes, and one that would, that local tax proposal would increase the voter threshold for citizen qualified sales tax measures to two-thirds vote. So we are watching that one very closely. Quickly on the budget, as I'm sure you have all heard, Sacramento is facing a budget deficit, although depending on who you talk to, you will hear different things about just how much of a structural budget is the legislature and the governor trying to resolve now. I think that third sub-bullet under the January budget headline is the one that is most important as I look at what's going on in Sacramento right now, that the governor intends to resolve any budget deficit in the 26-27 year as well as 27-28. So that's what we're looking forward to with the May revise, is a budget that somehow resolves a $25 to $35 million deficit. So definitely some very difficult budget conversations coming up. Quickly, I want to point out, I'll go back to the last slide really quick, if you don't mind, that cap and invest revenues, unfortunately, are anemic. At this point in time, we're projecting about 70% of the historic revenues the state has generated from that, which will impact potential grant programs that CVAG may or may not be interested in into the future. And then finally, this is something I'm keenly monitoring, something that I'm working with the League and CSAC on, is while a majority of transportation funding is constitutionally protected, there is a trailer bill proposal, which is where they do legislative activity inside the budget, around sustainable aviation fuel, specifically a diesel excise tax rebate, that could result in a loss of $1.5 billion in transportation funding over the next decade that will directly impact cities and counties, what they receive for their public works budgets and what is available in terms of state highway operations and maintenance projects, as well as access and funding amounts to the SB1 Trade Corridor Enhancement Program. So we'll see what shakes out with that budget proposal. Lots of opposition from local and regional government associations, but also a lot of support from Phillips 66 and in the state building trades, trying to maintain that facility as a sustainable aviation fuel facility in the state of California. Okay, next slide. We're also monitoring what's going on Proposition 4 implementation. The governor's January budget also proposed another $2.1 or $2 billion in expenditures for some key programs CVAG is interested in. And so we're monitoring ongoing implementation of the revenues that were authorized in the current budget year, as well as advocating for funding for those key programs of importance to the Coachella Valley. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. We'll skip that one for now. This was just a reminder of what that cap and trade funding waterfall looks like per the new, and I should say cap and invest. I still haven't quite gotten the new nomenclature under my belt. Essentially, $4.3 billion is needed annually to fulfill all of the obligations that the legislature would like to do with cap and invest going forward. Next slide, please. Oh, there you go. Next one. There is a bill that we are supporting. I believe off the top of my head, it's SB 35 or AB 35 that would waive the Administrative Procedures Act so that Prop 4 guidelines and programs can get off the ground quicker. CVAG is joined by dozens and dozens, potentially hundreds of organizations in support of that legislation. And so that looks to have a clear path going forward. Next slide, please. Oh, there you go, AB 35. Next slide, please. And then finally, I just want to touch on a couple of policy issues that are cooking in Sacramento. There are two different efforts looking at how to reform and make better SB 375, which are the regional transportation housing land use plans that set a pathway to reducing greenhouse gas emissions reductions. The Big Four MPO proposal is SCAG, SANDAG, MTC, and SACOG working on reforms. And I apologize, I'm noticing a typo right now. The bill is SB 1078, not 28, by Senator Cabaldon. There have been various proposals floating around that could go into that bill that could impact CVAG. So I am closely monitoring those conversations. And then CALSTA, the state agency over transportation, has a task force as well that's looking beyond SB 375 and looking at broader policy around how to incentivize sustainable communities. There is another bill that I think will be of interest to folks, particularly in the Inland Empire, where you are seeing significant population growth, demand for housing, and at least into the near future, some super commuters residing in your area that travel long distances to get to jobs. But AB 2059 by Assemblymember Lori Wilson is being amended this afternoon, which would provide some reforms for how you have to mitigate state highway projects and the creation of vehicle miles traveled. The long and the short of it is, even if VMT mitigations are positive improvements for the community, in some cases, they are effectively doubling the cost of state highway projects, which just means you get to do fewer of the projects your communities are hopefully looking for. So we will monitor that one as well. There's ongoing efforts to codify election procedures for citizen-led initiatives. There was a bill last year, CVAG was interested in, supported SB 512 that the governor vetoed, but the Self-Help Counties Coalition is taking the lead on trying to advance that this year. And then finally, to tie into the previous conversation about an ad hoc to talk about funding, Assemblymember Lori Wilson also has a bill, AB 1421, that studies the possibility of road user charging for the state. There's been a lot of media attention to this bill, and I'll just take a moment to clarify that the bill does not create a new tax. It does not create a new tax into the future. It's merely a study bill at this point in time. And she's going to be doing a series of regional town halls later this year, with one coming to the Inland Empire. So with that, I will let you know that we'll keep you posted as to when Ms. Wilson is in the district, in the region, and hopefully some of you will be able to participate in that convening. Next slide. Okay, I did that in just under 10 minutes. Sorry, I was going to try to be a little bit briefer. Happy to take any questions or comments that you have.
Thank you for the report. Any questions or thoughts by my colleagues?
I
have one. Go ahead.
So, you know, I just met with the head of the Coachella Valley Water District, and you know, there we're under a potential new law on this chromium six and the amount of chromium six that can be in the waters. Which has been reduced from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion. The federal standard is 100 parts per billion. And the famous Aaron Brockovich case was 11,000 parts per billion. So we are now in a situation where Coachella Valley Water District is having to implement a potential new piece of legislation at the cost of around $400 million to reduce chromium-6 in our water from 50 parts, which is one of the lowest in the world, to 10 parts, which is going to increase the cost of water to those people who have the least amount of money, for all of us, but it's going to impact, obviously, those people with the least amount of resources. There is currently a lawsuit in Fresno, specifically in Fresno, I'm told, because that particular court system has had success in challenging California state initiatives that, you know, I think we should all be aware of, and we should all potentially, to the extent we can, instruct or advise our legislative advisors to be aware of and push back wherever possible, because this particular measure impacts the eastern half of the state of California. It does not impact San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego, because those are surface water cities. So it's a specific directed piece of legislation to the eastern part of the state of California.
Yes, so Tober, that issue has been an ongoing issue forever. As a matter of fact, there's legislation that I remember that we passed back in the day when I was in the legislature, and I passed some bills as well dealing with that issue. And that goes back to the wells. And obviously cost a lot of money to try to make that happen. There was discussion made back then about maybe a lawsuit, but no one ever went through with it. I knew, you know, Fresno was going to, you know, take a stab at it, but that's great.
They're in it.
And maybe potentially we should do the same. But if you've had that conversation with CVWD, you know, hopefully we'd like to get maybe more information from them. I'm not sure that's something you want to bring up another day, but I think it's an issue that's basically impacting in the Coachella Valley, anyone that's in Wells, but specifically, for the most part, in the eastern Coachella Valley, North Shore, Mecca, Thermal, folks that don't have direct pipe and water coming from CVWD, that's really where they're being impacted. And you're right, when the beds went from, well, we had it at, what, 50 or something like that, went to 10?
That's California, not the feds.
Yeah, okay, so when that happened, that was on behalf of environmentalists doing that.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's supposed to be doing a good thing, but at the end of the day, I don't know if it's doing a good thing, because it's going to make it very difficult for us to move forward, especially for those farm workers that they were trying to help. You know, how are they going to survive having to maybe pay another water bill that's going to be much higher than what they're used to? So I think, Emmanuel, I'm not sure if you were part of that back in the day, but I remember you might have been. And so appreciate you bringing that up. And I think that'd be something for us to follow.
I do too. And of course, there's a huge negotiation going on right now with the seven states for the Colorado River water that expires December 31st, 2026. So that's going to get very exciting.
Any other thoughts or questions by my colleagues for Ms. Valentine? All right. Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
And any public comments on non-agenda items by anybody? Then, okay, announcements. Next meeting, Executive Committee, will be held on Monday, April 27th at 4 o'clock here at these chambers, so Water District, Steve Robbins Administration Building. And now we're going to go ahead and move towards closed session. However, we probably want to take a small break.
I think you do want to take a vote to go into closed session. Is that what we do, Nick?
The policies do call for a vote.
How many items do we have in closed session?
Just the one.
Okay. So, folks, we're going to ask for our support, I guess, for a closed session.
Do you want me to read the title?
Go ahead.
So the policies require that the committee note the purpose of closed session before going in and then vote on it. It's public employee performance evaluation, government code section 54957B1 for the executive director.
There's support for closed session to be discussed.
Move for closed session.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, second. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And Joey?
No.
I'm going to go
with okay.
No as well,
LaKington. All right, two no's. Any other no's? Everybody else is aye, I guess, is that where we're at? I want to make sure we document that for the record. All right. So that ends our meeting, our regular meeting. This meeting is now adjourned. However, I would like to ask folks, take a restroom break, water break, whatever you got to do.
Okay, we're going to stay on the same Zoom thing.
Yeah,
staying on Zoom.
Attendees, there's another Zoom link, and it's on your calendar.
Okay, so I got to get back off and come back on again.
You got to log off of this one and join the other
10 minutes,
Zoom.
Folks. I got to run to the bathroom myself.
Is it 5:30? Yeah, 5:30.
5:30.
Okay. The executive committee met in closed session, and there was no reportable action.